go more efficiently. She did not languish in useless yoga positions, and she did not spend precious minutes trying to entice Zach to pick up a Cheerio. She accomplished more. She found herself with a spare hour before pickup, and when was the last time that had happened? She could cut Pan a break and take Zach for a walk to the beach. But she wanted to return to Locke on Monday with a gift, a surprise, a thank you for the change he had brought about in her life, and so she took the phone into her room and locked the door. She rifled through her address book, which was filled with the torn corners of envelopes and assorted "We've moved" announcements. Claire did herself the favor of dating these things, but she never found time to write them down. Matthew Westfield, a.k.a. Max West. There was a cell phone number, which Claire knew to be useless. The last time Claire had tried to contact him was 2 years earlier, on behalf of Siobhan's brother, Declan, in Dublin, who wanted concert tickets. She had been unable to reach Matthew on the cell phone that time, and so she left a message for him with his agent, Bruce, in L.A., and sure enough, tickets arrived by DHL on Declan's doorstep. But the last time Claire had actually spoken to Matthew was nearly a dozen years earlier. He had called her from the Minneapolis airport. He was on his way to Hazelden for rehab.
"I can't beat it, Claire," Matthew had said then. "The bottle. I can't fucking beat it."
The bottle, Claire thought, should have been easier than the cocaine. But in the past 12 years, Matthew had been in 3 times for alcohol abuse. Claire thought back to high school. In those days, she was the only one who could get away with buying beer. She put her hair in hot rollers and wore her mother's long black skirt and sensible flat shoes. She looked, Matthew used to say, like one of the Amish, but she never once got carded. They drank in fields, in the woods, and in summertime at the quarry, where Matthew, plastered, used to dive into the jade-green water from the highest outcrop of rocks. He had been so cavalier. He had thought himself indestructible. They drank at the beach, or at one of the empty rental houses on the street across from the beach. They wandered the boardwalk, ogling its carnival atmosphere, the blue and green neon spokes of the Ferris wheel, the strings of round lights outlining the kettle corn, taffy, and slushy stands, the hundreds of kitschy shops, greetings from Wildwood, with a sense of hilarious wonder. The drinking had been innocent, a mood enhancer, and it was rebellion too, of course. It was usually only part of the night and not the night itself. Though there were exceptions to that, nights when either she or Matthew, or both of them, drank so much that they puked until dawn. For the most part, the nights of their youth had been about music. Matthew took his guitar everywhere. He slung it over his back and placed it next to them on the beach or in the grass when they made love. He sang to their group of friends, to strangers. He sang to Claire. He sang to himself. There had been plenty of times when Claire grew jealous of the music, when she accused Matthew of being obsessed with it. Music was his drug back then. It surprised Claire that alcohol had reached out and grabbed Matthew, as an adult, by the neck. Why him and not her? Of course, his life, in the interim between their last month together, August 1987, and the present, had contained excesses such as Claire could only imagine. Matthew had told her about some of it. The drugs, the alcohol, the girls, the parties, the complete lack of scruples characteristic of a rock and roll tour bus. There was not one wholesome thing about his Stormy Eyes tour, not one night where he drank water and went to bed early, not one sentence uttered without a swear word, not one steamed vegetable, not one breath of air that didn't contain the sweet suggestion of marijuana smoke. It was all vodka and tits, he said, and pressure. That was the real monkey on his back. The pressure. Claire had spoken to Matthew in the Minneapolis airport as he awaited his escort to Hazelden for nearly an hour. Mostly, it was him talking, reminiscing, apologizing.
"I should never have let you go. We were happy."
"Happy," she said.
"Your father hated me."
"He did not."
Your mother thought I sang off key.
Don't be silly. She thought you had the voice of an angel.
Remember when I sang at the pony? Things were simple then.
Simple, Claire said. She laughed. Remember when you let me play the tambourine?
You were a regular Tracy Partridge.
She could hear him smiling.
I miss you, he said. If you ever need anything, anything at all.
Or if you ever need anything, she said.
Ask, he said.
Ask, she said.
So,
she had an ancient cell phone number and Bruce's number in L.A. Call Bruce. It was only October. If Max called her back in 3 weeks or a month or even 2 months, that would still leave plenty of time to book him as the talent. Or she could write to Matthew's mother, Sweet Jane Westfield, who still lived on East Astor Road in Wildwood Crest. Claire got a Christmas card from her every year. Sweet Jane was the one constant in Matthew's life. If Jane received a note from Claire, she would pin it to her corkboard over the sink. Claire could see the corkboard plain as day, as well as the crocheted cover that went over the tea kettle, and she would mention it to Matthew when he called, which he did every Sunday. Claire would do both. She found Sweet Jane's address in her book and handwrote a note in large print explaining that she needed to get a hold of Matthew. She wanted Matthew to play a short concert here on Nantucket to benefit a children's charity. It's not for me, Claire wrote. It's for the island kids. Would you please have him call me? My number is... In a P.S., she mentioned that her kids were doing well. No doubt Sweet Jane still had Zach's birth announcement pinned to the corkboard, and she asked after Monty, Sweet Jane's cat. Next, she dialed Bruce Mandalay, Matthew's agent. Bruce Mandalay was the person who discovered Matthew at the Stone Pony. It came as a surprise because although there were always agents and managers and record producers at the Stone Pony, thanks to Springsteen and Bon Jovi, they were normally easy to pick out. They had slick hair and diamond earrings. They wore suits. Bruce Mandalay looked like a manager at a box factory. He was ordinary. Paunchy, balding, with rimless glasses and a mustache and sturdy wingtip shoes. He was soft-spoken, non-threatening to the point of invisibility. Matthew had signed with him because he was serious, smart, sensible. Bruce thought the song Parents Know could be a single. He offered to put the money up himself to have Matthew record it professionally in New York. Matthew did so, and then, almost immediately, Bruce hooked him up with Columbia. Just like that, Matthew shot toward the stars. When Matthew went to New York to record the single, he'd insisted Claire come along. She rode in the back of Bruce's Pinto from Wildwood to Manhattan. Bruce had treated her nicely, better than she had thought a tag-along girlfriend would be treated. At a rest stop, Bruce bought her a cheeseburger and a Coke. He asked her about college. She told him, RISD, and he said,
impressive.
He had five daughters himself, he said. But as Matthew became more important to Bruce, Claire became less important. When she showed up backstage at the Beacon Theater 18 months later, Max West was opening for the Allman Brothers, Bruce didn't recognize her. Was she that forgettable, or were there just so many girls by then that Bruce couldn't keep track? Claire had been out of touch for so long now that she might have to remind Bruce who she was, but that was okay. There had been hundreds of girls for Matthew, possibly even thousands, including two wives and one unfortunate mistress, the most famous actress of modern times. But Claire had the distinction of being the first girl, the one Matthew had loved before he was famous.
Hello, Bruce Mandalay.
Bruce, Claire said. This is Claire Danner calling.
There was a pause.
Well, the request for tickets had been 2 years ago, and it was possible that Claire had an inflated view of her importance in Matthew's history. I'm Matthew's...
Yes, Bruce said. Claire, yes, hello.
His voice sounded the same, very calm and metered. He was a non-agent agent, Nothing got him excited or riled up. Being Max West's agent must have made him a rich and powerful man, but you would never know it. Claire wondered about his five daughters. They had been younger than Claire, but by now they were all grown. Bruce might even be a grandfather. Claire didn't have time to ask. She had to pick up the kids from school in 15 minutes. I have a favor to ask, Bruce.
Tickets? Bruce said. Max is in Southeast Asia. He's not playing in the States again until spring.
It's not tickets, Claire said. It was so much more than tickets that she wasn't sure how to ask. A free 90-minute concert on a baseball diamond for 1,000 wealthy summer people who might not even dance. She'd eaten a salami sandwich for lunch, and now she had heartburn.
No, Bruce said, and his voice sounded both interested and wary.
I'm the co-chair of a benefit here on Nantucket, Claire said. It's called the Summer Gala. It's cocktails and dinner for 1,000 people, and traditionally there's a concert.
Silence.
It's a charity event, Claire said. $1,000 a ticket, and all the money goes to this organization I'm involved with called Nantucket's Children.
Silence.
I want Max, to play it.
Silence.
For free.
Had Bruce hung up? She wouldn't have blamed him if he had.
It's August 16th, a Saturday, Claire said, here on Nantucket. Nantucket is off the coast of...
I know where Nantucket is.
Okay, Claire said. She took a deep breath. What do you think? She heard the shuffling of papers. Bruce Mandalay cleared his throat.
Hollywood Hospice, Doctors Without Borders, Save the Children, the United Way of Orange County, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Dade County SPCA, the Druckenheimer Center for the Elderly of St. Louis, the Capistan School for the Blind, the Red Cross, the Seattle Symphony, the Redbone Fishing Tournament for Cystic Fibrosis, the Home for Retarded Citizens of Rock City, Iowa, the Conservancy Project of Estes Park, the First Baptist Church of Tupelo, the Jackson, Mississippi Botanical Gardens, the Cleveland Clinic, Arthur Ashe Youth Tennis and Education, Data, that's Bono's thing in Africa, the Mount Rushmore Restoration Concern.
Okay, Claire said. Stop, I get it. Bruce sighed. He was a non-agent agent, and he had bought the cheeseburger and the Coke for Claire so long ago, when she had no money for lunch herself. But he wasn't exactly kind, either. Maybe he had been kind at one time, but representing Max West through 20 years of meteoric success had made him a realist. It was hard to be a realist and kind. Claire, he said. She should never have called. She should have mailed the letter to Sweet Jane and waited to hear back. Jane Westfield was sweet. She was kind. She had known Claire since Claire was 12 years old. She wouldn't give Claire a song and dance. But what really did Claire know? Maybe she would. Claire felt like she was going to cry. It was rejection, plain and simple, and the thing was, she deserved it, for being so smug, for assuming that she had been an unforgettable influence in Matthew's life. You don't forget your high school sweetheart, do you? But maybe you did. She hadn't seen Matthew in forever and a day.
Locke doesn't think you'll be able to deliver.
She couldn't deliver. She experienced vestiges of an old hurt. Claire, out behind the stone pony, hugging Matthew, holding on to him for dear life, knowing she was going to lose him. And it was combined with the hurt she was going to feel when she told Locke Dixon, who admired her and believed in her, that she couldn't get Max West.
It's okay, she whispered. I get it. All those people want him.
Those are just the requests from this month, Bruce said.
This is what's come in since he's been gone.
He turned down Bono, Claire. And nearly all of the organizations are willing to pay.
I know, Claire said. I just thought I'd ask.
You were right to ask.
Bruce said. He was quiet again, and Claire thought, please, let's just end this call. Did he expect her to make nice and ask about his daughters now? Do you know who I work for? He said.
Who?
Claire said. Max West.
Right.
He's like my own son, Bruce said. I know everything about him. For example, I know he's in Brunei right now, jonesing like crazy because the Sultan is Muslim and his kingdom is dry.
Right, Claire said.
There were only 10 minutes until pickup. She had to hang up.
Listen, would you do me a favor? If you talk to Max, will you tell him I called and just ask him? Tell him it's really, really important to me.
I don't have to ask him, Bruce said. I know everything about him. If I tell him you called and asked for this crazy, inconceivable thing, I know what he'll say.
What?
He'll say yes.
What?
He'll say, for Claire Danner, yes. Free concert, no problem, sure. Saturday, August 16th. You're lucky because he happens to be free. He flies to Spain a few days later. So, yes, he'll be there.
Claire stood up from the bed. She started to bounce. She couldn't help herself, but she didn't want Bruce to know she was bouncing. Really? She said. You think?
I don't think, Bruce said. I know. He'll be there.
Chapter 4. He surprises her. On Sunday, Jason and J.D. spent all day scalloping, and on Monday night, Claire sautéed the scallops for dinner and served them with risotto and asparagus. Claire wanted Jason to be happy about dinner because he was not happy to hear she had another gala meeting.
Is this what it's going to be like? He asked. 2-3 nights a week, you at meetings, leaving me with the kids?
They're your kids, too, Claire said. It will be good for you to spend time with them. It'll be good for them to spend time with you.
Just answer my question, Jason said. Is this what it's going to be like?
Only at first, Claire promised blindly.
I told you. It was a mistake. You should have said no.
Well, I can't back out now, can I?
No,
Jason said grudgingly. No, Claire said. There had been a crackled message on the machine, left late Friday night while Jason and Claire were at Joe's 40th birthday party. It was Matthew, calling from Brunei, saying he was coming to Nantucket in August.
I can't wait to see you again, he said. God, this is going to be great.
Even Jason was impressed with Claire for locking up Max West so quickly, so easily, and for free. Claire had let the news slip after a couple of glasses of champagne at Joe's birthday party. Looks like Max West is playing the gala. And voila. 5 people agreed to be on her committee, including Julie Jackson's husband, Brent. Hooray! Claire might have been a rock star herself. Joe's wife put a Max West CD on the stereo and everyone danced, and Claire heard Jason say,
yeah, he'll probably stay with us. He's crazy about Claire. They dated, you know, in high school. They nearly got married.
So there was no backing out now. The kids regarded their dinner plates dolefully. Even J.D., who had been so proud of bringing home 2 bushels of scallops, didn't want to eat them.
Do we have to? Shay asked.
Yes, Jason said. He was snarfing down his food, but Claire just picked at her plate, not unlike the kids. She had called Locke that morning and said, I have something to tell you. He'd said,
great, what is it?
I'd like to tell you in person. She waited a beat. 2, 3. He sounded like he was shuffling papers. Did he get it? He said,
can you meet tonight?
As Claire climbed the stairs of the Elijah Baker house, she felt weightless and sick. The symptoms were the same as heat stroke. Shallow breathing, hot, dry skin, rocketing heart rate,
She was going to pass out. How was she getting one foot in front of the other? She was climbing the stairs to meet with Locke. That was all. The thought that it might be something more was completely inane. Affairs only happen in novels and on TV. But that wasn't exactly true, was it? Every winter, someone on Nantucket had an affair. The circuit judge, or the high school chemistry teacher, or the woman who gave private piano lessons. And everyone else heard about the gory details. Caught in bed with a manager from the Atlantic Cafe. Threw her belongings into the front yard. Siobhan was a big fan of the annual affair story. She was the first to castigate the couple for having an affair and for getting caught.
Immoral, sneaky, deceptive people, Siobhan said gleefully. Stupid. Careless.
What always crossed Claire's mind was how brave the person must have been, and how unhappy. Claire was not brave. She hadn't had the courage to suggest a night meeting herself. She had merely willed Locke to do it. And Claire wasn't unhappy. She loved her kids. She loved Jason. She had Siobhan and a host of other friends. She had full-time help and a newfound zest for her work. She was not unhappy. And since she was not brave and not unhappy, nothing would happen. She would tell Locke the incredible news about Matthew. It was such big news it should be announced in person. And then she would leave. The office was so dark that Claire thought it must be uninhabited, and immediately she panicked. Had Locke forgotten? If he had forgotten, she would be wounded but also relieved. She would slip out of the office and try to forget that anything interesting had ever transpired there. But then she rounded the corner into the office, and there was Locke at his computer, working. The desk lamp was off, as was the radio. There was very little light, and no music, and no sandwich, no wine. But Locke was there, at the computer, wearing his glasses. Claire studied him. He was just a person. A balding, slightly overweight, middle-aged man with deep eyes and a magnetic smile. And maybe this was the most attractive thing about him. An unquestionable authority. Hi, Claire said. He took off his glasses and rubbed his eyes, as though he were having a dream that was too good to believe.
I saw you coming down the street, he said.
Did you?
I did. I've been watching for you for, about 5 days.
Oh, Claire said. She was tongue-tied and jumbled up. Had he really just said that? Had he meant it? She wanted to say something equally sweet back to him, but it was as if she was holding an instrument she didn't know how to play. No matter what she said, she would strike the wrong note. He stood up, and she approached the desk. She thought they were taking their places. She would sit in the chair, and he would sit on the edge of the desk. But he bypassed the desk and came toward her. She stopped. He stopped. Locke looked at her, and her stomach dropped away. Whoosh. Gone. He touched Claire's cheek, then ran his thumb across her lips. He kissed her. Oh. It was so deeply entrenched as a fantasy in Claire's interior life that she couldn't believe it was actually happening. Locke Dixon kissed her only once. Then he pulled away. Claire thought she might fall over backward. She was afraid to move, afraid to speak. She was in a bubble where all that mattered was that Locke had kissed her and might kiss her again. Claire, he said. He spoke her name with wonder and respect, as if it was a beautiful name, as if she was a beautiful woman. Was she a beautiful woman? She hardly ever felt beautiful. She was too harried, too often in her yoga pants, with her wild red hair in a bun. Jason came after her in bed all the time, But did he think she was beautiful? If she asked him, he would laugh and say something patronizing. The part of their marriage that had dissolved was the part where he told her she was beautiful. It was the part where they held hands at dinner or had a drink together in front of the fire. It was the part where, when she said she had something to talk to him about, he turned off the TV instead of merely muting it. The part of their marriage that had dissolved was the breathlessness of moments like this one. I don't know what to say. This, the truth, from her. He nodded. I'm going to kiss you again, okay? She nodded. He kissed her, more deeply, for longer, a full second, then two. Her mouth opened. She tasted him. It was heaven. She was 12 years old. This was her first kiss. It stayed innocent like that, just the kissing. No part of their bodies touched except for their lips, their tongues. It was sweet and intoxicating. Claire ached for him. Did he ache for her? She had no idea. She knew enough about relationships, though, to pull back first. Is this wise? She said. Now she sounded like the person she knew herself to be. What if someone finds us up here in the dark? Someone like who? Locke said. He touched her face again. He held it with both his hands so that her face felt small and delicate, like a child's face, a doll's face. Like Gavin Andrews, Claire thought, or Daphne, or Jason, or Adams Fisk. But she didn't speak. She was too wrapped by Locke's hands on her face, and in the next second, by his kissing her. They were kissing again. Claire's mind was a tornado. Why was this happening? Why her, of all people? Had he had feelings for her for a while, or were his feelings newly hatched, like her own feelings? Would this go any further? Locke Dixon had an unquestionable authority. He was a leader, a commander. He knew what he was doing at all times. Claire didn't have to be brave. He would be brave for both of them. She would be swept up behind him on horseback, and he would gallop them across the fields. And if he knew she was thinking all these preposterous things, he wouldn't want to be kissing her anymore. At the same time that Claire's mind was mowing down all her previous convictions and expectations, she was present in the physicality of the moment. She was kissing him, tasting him, feeling the heat of his palms on her face, then in her hair, then against her back. He pressed himself against her, and she took a stutter step backward, and he caught her. She pulled away. What are we doing? She said. Right, he said. I don't know. Okay, Claire said, relieved. Good. Do you want to stop? He said. He sounded concerned, almost scared. Am I pressuring you into something you'd rather not be doing?
No.
I don't have an explanation, he said. I am as stunned as you are. It's like someone cast a spell on me. From the moment you set foot in here for the first meeting.
The first meeting, Claire said. But not before, not at the lunch. Not 2 years ago or 5 years ago. I've known you a while.
But not really, Locke said. Right?
Right, Claire said. I thought you hated me.
She remembered his eyes when she showed up at the front door with that basket for Daphne. That horrible look. Hated you?
Because of Daphne. The night of her accident. I bought her last drink and then the cab. We asked her to join us. We begged her, but she refused.
And you thought I hated you?
Blamed me, yes. I blame myself.
Because you're that kind of person. A caring person. You would worry. You would blame yourself for something that was very clearly not your fault.
Locke loosened his tie. His white shirt was turned back neatly at the cuffs. His watch glinted in the lamplight.
I've known for a long time that you're a good person,
good like the rest of us aspire to be. And I've admired your work. But then you walked in here and we spent time together and suddenly it dawned on me that I am a lonely man.
Claire's mind flickered to the half-eaten turkey and cranberry sandwich on white butcher paper, to the daughter, Heather, at Andover, studying, eating, playing field hockey, and sleeping, all under the supervision of people who were not her parents.
I have been lonely for so long, he said, but I didn't feel lonely until I spent that hour with you.
So I made you feel lonely?
You made me feel unlonely. And then you left, and I couldn't stop thinking about you.
I had the same problem, Claire said.
I am not like this, he said. I have not kissed a woman other than my wife in 20 years.
Really, was this true? Claire thought of Isabel French. What about Isabel French?
What about her?
I saw your wife at the grocery store. She seemed to think there might be something going on between you and Isabel French.
She said that?
Claire looked at the floor. Now she had the weirdly unpleasant feeling that she'd betrayed Daphne's confidence, which felt like a worse offense somehow than kissing Locke. Yes, Claire said.
Daphne doesn't always realize what she's saying.
This was a generous spin on the way things were, but Claire wasn't going to argue with Locke about Daphne's state of mind.
I have no feelings for Isabel French, he said, other than compassion.
Compassion?
Bad divorce, Locke said, and some subsequent bad decisions.
I haven't met her yet, Claire said.
You will.
Yes. This sounded sort of like a discussion about the gala, which was odd because they were standing very close to each other, closer than normal people would stand. Claire was inside Locke's orbit. She was a captive of his magnetic field.
It's like someone cast a spell on me.
Was this total bullshit? God knows it sounded like it. If Jason had heard Locke speak those words, he would have guffawed and choked on his spit. He would have questioned Locke's sincerity, and possibly his sexual orientation. But that was how Claire felt, too. She had attended the lunch at the yacht club terrified of Locke Dixon, but after the first meeting, she was thinking about him in a whole new way, thinking about him all the time. He'd wooed her somehow. And now they were kissing. And she didn't understand it, and he didn't either, apparently, and that came as a relief. He was not a brave horseman after all. If it did turn into something more, it would be the two of them bumbling their way through the dark, which felt like something Claire might be able to handle. Since they were on the topic of the gala, sort of, Claire decided to bring up the ostensible reason she was here. I got Max West, she said. He'll do it for free.
I know, Locke said. I heard.
How? Claire said. How do you know?
Someone told me.
Who?
I promised not to reveal my source. It was someone you were at a party with over the weekend.
So, one of 25 people. It was a very small island. I thought you'd be shocked. You didn't think I could do it.
Of course I did.
So you're proud of me?
I'm proud of you.
He leaned forward and kissed her on the forehead. I started sketching the chandelier, she said.
That's great, he said.
It is great, Claire said. I've been wanting to get back into the hot shop. I just needed a push.
I'm nothing if not pushy, he said.
He checked his watch.
I should get home.
Stupidly. This pierced her. Claire had thought he would try to persuade her to stay. Didn't he want her to stay? Didn't he want to kiss her some more? She had only been having an affair for 20 minutes and already she was jealous. Okay, she said. Thank God for words like okay, employable in any situation, even when what you meant was the opposite of okay. Claire had to get out of there. She was in danger of sinking into an emotional quagmire. She hadn't taken her jacket off, and hence she couldn't busy herself with putting it back on. There was nothing left to do but turn and go. Was that what she should do? So I'll see you. She wanted to know if this was it. Would there be more? And if there was to be more, then when and where?
We have a meeting Wednesday night, Locke said.
Right, Claire said. She had mentioned Wednesday's meeting to the people who had volunteered for the committee. She would have to call and remind them. I'll see you Wednesday, then. She turned to go. Yes, go. And he took her arm. He pulled her to him. She filled with elation. He wasn't ready to let her go. He kissed her so gently that she emitted a sigh, and then he kissed her more hungrily. He wanted her. She could feel him wanting her. She could feel his arms around her trembling, with fear or lust, or in an attempt to hold himself back. She had no idea. But she loved it. The person she was, a good person, a person committed to kindness, who showed up with a basket of soup and soap, a peace offering, did not do things like this. But Locke's trembling, his kiss, was a drug, a rush, an attraction too powerful to resist. Claire thought of Jason and of her kids, and they seemed distant, but sweet, too, and simple, and safe. What was she doing? She was too easy. She was the universal acceptor. Locke pressed her up against the wall. He ran his hands up inside her sweater. He touched her nipples, lightly, with his palms. She gasped. His touch was electric. She should go now. She'd asked for this in her mind, and here it was. Amazing, foreign, scary. Because what came next? What happened now? This was all still relatively innocent. It had yet to take on heavy, cumbersome labels like adultery or cheating. This was leading to serious trouble, to something Claire would regret, something she would not be able to wish away or undo. And yet, she didn't want to stop. She didn't want to pull away. She didn't want to. His hands were on her waist. He tugged at her belt loops. You made me feel unlonely.
We should go, she whispered.
Yes, he said. They did not stop. They kissed. He touched her. She was afraid to touch him, so she kept her hands on his arms and noted how strong and solid his muscles were and how soft his shirt was. She ran her fingers up his arms to his shoulders. She touched the collar of his shirt and the back of his neck, and he pulled back and said, It has been so long since someone touched me like that.
Claire felt wistful, thinking of Locke, who was rich, yes, who had unquestionable authority, who was good-hearted and right and smart, but who was so lonely. He was not Derek Jeter or Brad Pitt, but despite this, Claire was sure he could have had any woman he wanted, and he had picked her. She touched his ears and the very short hair on the back of his head. She was manhandled 4 times a week by Jason. But she understood Locke's longing.
Really, she said. We should go.
Claire did not know anything about affairs, but she was an expert when it came to finesse and timing. These were the gifts of a glassblower. Knowing not to blow a piece out too thin, knowing when to back off, when to cool a piece down. She felt that way now. They couldn't go any further. He released her, reluctantly. The reluctance was what she savored.
I'll see you Wednesday, she said.
And she slipped down the stairs. As Claire descended the stairs of the office into the crisp, smoky autumn air, she felt like she was filling up with bubbles or feathers.
Locke Dixon had kissed her. They had kissed. He did not hate her after all. He liked her. God, she couldn't believe it. She had been thinking of this, of him, but carefully, circumspectly. Because never once had she allowed herself to believe that he might reciprocate her feelings, her intense curiosity, her nascent desire. What she'd had, basically, was a crush. And crushes were never mutual. But yes, tonight, yes. Claire floated to her car, feeling as if she would explode in a burst of light, or flower petals, or paper confetti. She wanted to tell someone, and that, of course, meant Siobhan. But even as Claire palmed her cell phone, she knew she could never tell Siobhan. Siobhan, although she was Claire's best friend and the closest thing to a sister Claire had ever had, would not be able to handle this news. This was not some half-baked fantasy about the trash boy or the UPS man knocking on the door and Claire or Siobhan inviting him in. This was not Siobhan putting a dare out there and then jumping out of harm's way at the last minute. This was real. This had happened. Claire could not tell Siobhan. She could not tell anyone. On Tuesday, Claire broke her own rules. She didn't even know she had rules, but as she climbed the stairs of the Elijah Baker house, her heart hammering, she knew this was not wise, showing up the very next day out of the blue. And yet, she couldn't help herself. Bruce Mandelay had sent Claire a fax at home, the contract and rider for Max West's performance, and Claire wanted to drop it off for Locke or Adams to peruse. Matthew was playing for free, but there were some things in the paperwork that concerned Claire. He was bringing Terry and Alfonso from his band. Bass and drums, he never played without them, and they needed to be paid $10,000 apiece. In addition, Nantucket's Children was in charge of hiring four contract musicians, who also had to be paid. There were pages of production notes which Claire could not make heads or tails of. Spotlights, instruments, amps, sound systems, microphones. The rider specified that the band had to be put up in five-star accommodations, with all kinds of food and drink, down to the cherry Italian ice, Nilla wafers, and quick chocolate milk, which made Claire laugh because it reminded her of late-night trips to the 7-Eleven 25 years earlier. The most alarming thing was a clause at the end of the contract, which Locke was supposed to sign, regarding the fact that because of Matthew's drug and alcohol problems, Bruce couldn't ensure the performance. A post-it note was stuck to this page, written in Bruce's hand. He's doing this as a personal favor to Claire, and wild horses won't keep him away, but... But it was Matthew. He was always at the mercy of his addictions. Claire wanted to give the contract and rider to Locke as soon as possible. This was business. It was all in the name of attacking her line items before the meeting. She had every reason to be stopping by the office, and yet she felt obvious, as if she was throwing herself at Locke's feet. The classical music was playing. Claire knocked on the doorframe and poked her head in. Her eyes went right to Locke's desk. Empty. Claire? Gavin Andrews looked at her expectantly from behind his desk. Hi, Gavin, how are you?
Me?
Gavin said. He looked down at his red and navy striped tie, like something a prep school kid would wear, as if checking on himself.
I'm fine.
Claire didn't actually hear him say fine. She was too busy scanning the office. No Locke, and at the same time trying to discern if Locke was in the boardroom or the kitchen or the bathroom. No, he wasn't here. She felt relief first, then deflation. Is Locke here? Claire asked pointlessly.
He's at lunch with some donors, Gavin said. What can I help you with?
Claire regarded Gavin. She didn't like him, and it had nothing to do with his being a pale replacement for Locke. Gavin was best described as smug, snooty, and condescending. Also, he was hard to pin down. Who was he?
How old was he? Claire put him at 35, though he might have been 32 or 39. He was exceptionally good-looking, with blonde hair and clear green eyes and smooth-shaven cheeks, and like Locke, he always wore a shirt and tie. But he was persnickety and critical. The one time Claire had engaged him in a personal conversation, he told her that as a rule, he never dated a woman more than 3 times. More than 3 times, he said, and they started sniffing around for a wedding ring. Gavin lived in his parents' house out by Cisco Beach. His parents were older. They lived in Chicago and only made it to Nantucket for the month of August. The parents had money, though it was unclear how much of this trickled down to Gavin. He was forever complaining of the high cost of living on Nantucket, though Claire assumed he lived rent-free, and he was always approaching the board with a pay raise, which Locke supported, saying, "He is very organized and fastidious." Overall, Claire regarded Gavin with suspicion. He was living here on Nantucket in his parents' house, working as a glorified secretary, wasting all his obvious potential, his looks, his articulateness and poise, his college education. Why? He was perfectly nice with Claire and the other board members, though Claire sensed him looking down his nose at her. He thought, as did Daphne Dixon, maybe they even talked about it, that Claire was sloppy and unkempt, that she was a flaky artist who reproduced like a rabbit. All those children. And she was married to that carpenter caveman who smoked and spat and fished and drank Bud Light out of cans and drove a black pickup named Darth Vader. Pompous laughter, barely stifled. Gavin was Claire's opposite. He looked like he went home and showered at lunchtime. His shirt and pants were crisp like the pages of a new book, and he was single-minded in his devotion to Locke Dixon and the seamless administration of Nantucket's children. Claire dropped the contract on his desk in a way that was probably rude. "You heard we got Max West to play the gala?" He nodded once, solemnly. "Locke told me. Congratulations." "Don't congratulate me, congratulate us. We should make a lot of money." "Indeed we should." "Do you like Max West?" Claire asked. "Have you ever seen him in concert?" "I listen to classical, Claire. You know that."
"But not only classical."
"Only classical. And jazz every once in a while on the weekends."
"But no rock music?" Claire said. "No blues, no rap, no country? No music with words?"
Gavin smiled at her. The classical music came across as an affectation, as did the red and white Mini Cooper that Gavin drove. The sight of him in that car bugged her, though she couldn't say why.
"This is the contract and the rider. I'd like Locke to look at them, go over them with Adams, whatever the usual procedure is."
Gavin straightened the papers. "They will go most directly into Locke's inbox."
"Thank you, Gavin."
Claire beamed as warmly as she could.
"Is there anything else?"
Claire eyed the clock. It was 10 minutes to 1. Lunch with donors? Had he left at 12 or 12:30? What if she left right now and missed him by a matter of seconds?
"I have some questions about the catering of the gala."
Gavin said. "What would those be?"
Claire paused. She didn't know how to handle the whole catering question. Claire had asked Siobhan to sit on the gala committee automatically, right away, because Siobhan was her best friend, and Claire wanted to include her. But it would be truly awkward if Siobhan sat on the committee and for some reason she and Carter didn't get the catering job, right? Anyone could see the tough position Claire was in. She wanted to proceed fairly, but the more she thought about it, the clearer it became that Claire would somehow have to secure the catering job for Siobhan. Claire eyed Gavin. Was it safe to spill her guts to him about this? It was not, she decided.
"My sister-in-law is interested in bidding the catering job," Claire said. "You know Siobhan and Carter, right? Island Fair?"
Gavin nodded once, briskly.
"So what is the procedure?"
"They are free to submit a bid," Gavin said. "We have 2 bids in already."
"You do?" It's a big deal, the gala, Gavin said, as if she didn't get it. Can I see the bids? Claire asked.
Well, technically, yes. I mean, you are the co-chair. But I'm going to have to ask you not to share the content of the bids with Carter and Siobhan. If you were, for example, to tell Siobhan what the price per head was and then she came in a couple of bucks under, that would fall outside the parameters of fair business practices. To keep your nose clean, I would suggest you not look at the bids. In fact, I would suggest you delegate catering to someone else. That's why you have a committee.
Right, Claire said reluctantly. How to explain to Gavin that Siobhan was Claire's best friend, and Claire could not deny her the catering. Can you tell me who gave you the bids, at least? Claire asked.
I could, Gavin said. I certainly could. You are the co-chair.
But what you have to ask yourself is, do you really want to know? Wouldn't it be better, from an ethical standpoint, to wash your hands of this? Because, you know, here in this office, we insist things be done in an above-board way.
Claire gazed at the wall next to Gavin's desk. Only 18 hours earlier, Locke Dixon had pressed her up against that wall. What would Gavin think if he knew? He would never believe it. And if he'd seen it with his own eyes, he would have fainted dead away. We insist things be done in an above-board way. Gavin was weaselly, Claire decided, and self-important. He was the kind of guy who assumed that any woman he went out with more than 3 times would want to marry him, and now he was treating the catering bids as if they were the Pentagon Papers. But unlike 3 weeks ago, when Claire had known nothing about the gala, had done nothing and contributed nothing, she now felt she had some clout, some bargaining power. She had delivered Max West promptly and free of charge. Surely she could lobby on Siobhan's behalf.
Is it really that big of a deal? Claire asked.
I'm just trying to keep everything on the up and up. You don't want your integrity called into question, do you?
Her integrity was becoming a tender spot already.
God, no, she said. You're right, forget I asked.
Gavin nodded again and got back to work, effectively dismissing her. You'll show Locke the contract?
When he gets back.
Okay. She couldn't really delay another second. Did she want to delay? Did she want to see Locke? Yes, desperately. But now she would be too nervous. She would be tongue-tied, and Gavin, with his sharp, discriminating eye, would detect something fishy afoot, something fishier than the catering bids. Get out of there. Goodbye. The following night, Wednesday, there was a real meeting. Jason grumbled, and Claire snapped at him for grumbling. He was angry that Claire had gone back to work, and she was angry that he was angry. She was more than angry, she was disillusioned. Jason didn't value her career, and not only did he not value it, but he hated it. He had told his own brother that he wanted to bomb Claire's hot shop, bomb it, like a terrorist. When Claire had heard him say those words, they had not seemed as egregious as they did now. Jason had asked Claire to give up her career. He made her feel like her career was evil. He did not appreciate or respect her work. Locke was responsible for getting Claire back into the hot shop. That was a bond that went beyond the kiss in the office. As she grabbed her purse, Jason said, "Have fun at your meeting."
"Thanks," Claire said with open hostility.
"I will."
Claire could see the lights of the Nantucket's children office blazing from half a block away. Then she saw Brent Jackson, Julie's husband, and Brent's friend Edward Melior, who had the distinction of having once been engaged to Siobhan, heading toward the office from Water Street. Claire waved, and they all climbed the stairs together, and Claire was glad she was entering the office with these handsome, successful men. Brent and Edward were both real estate agents, rather than alone. The office was a hive of activity.
Adams Fisk was there, shaking hands, pounding backs, directing people toward the boardroom. Francine Davis was there, one of Claire's recruits, as well as Lauren Van Aln. And the biggest coup, Tessa Klein, who was an editor at Nan Mag, the island's biggest, glossiest magazine. She would give them great press. Right away, it was a party of sorts. All these people, a veritable who's who of year-round islanders, and Claire was so overwhelmed and so pleased with herself for gathering these fine souls that she nearly forgot to look for Locke. There he was, in the corner, talking to a woman Claire didn't recognize. The woman was attractive, wearing a red silk Chinese jacket and jeans. She had the sort of long, straight hair that distracted men, and the hair was loose, which seemed like a come-on, a call for attention on a woman in her 40s. Why not pull it back or pin it up? The hair, a pretty light brown, was making some kind of statement, and Claire didn't like what it was saying. She felt as if her own hair, true, deep red and naturally wavy, was a Brillo pad in comparison. It was Ronald McDonald hair. She felt immediately defensive, not only about her hair, but about Locke's talking to an attractive woman. Claire realized, just as Locke turned and looked at her, blankly, as though he didn't recognize her, that the woman was Isabel French. Here, in person. Claire was taken aback. She had expected that Isabel would call from New York. She had been ready for a disembodied voice, not an intriguing flesh-and-blood presence. Locke said, "Claire," and waved her over in a way that made her feel like his servant. She tried to smooth the wrinkles in her mind. When she was working, and she blew out a piece too thin, or she marvored lopsidedly, the best thing to do was start over. Go back to the crucible and get a new gather. She could do that now, with Isabel. Start fresh, with a glob of molten possibility that could be coaxed into something divine. The room seemed to part as Claire made her way toward Locke and Isabel. Locke said, "Claire, this is Isabel French, your co-chair. Isabel Claire Crispin." Claire smiled. She and Isabel clasped hands like two heads of state. Claire could imagine the caption beneath their official photograph, "Gala co-chairs meet for the first time." "It's a pleasure to meet you," Isabel said. Her voice was smooth and rich and a touch smoky, like some kind of complicated sauce. "I know your work, of course." That was a nice touch, Claire thought. "I know your work." It made Claire feel like Gertrude Stein. "Thank you," she said. "It's nice to finally put a face to the name." This was the woman in the Indian print tunic whom Claire had seen at the benefit. Claire remembered seeing her one other time before that, from across the room at a board meeting. But Claire could never have guessed from either of those previous sightings that they would someday be shackled together. "Let's get started," Locke said. "Will everyone take a seat?" He pulled out a chair for Isabel and took the seat beside her. Claire felt a twinge of jealousy. Absurd. She remembered Daphne Dixon. "If she touches him, or if they spend time alone together, I want you to call me." But who was the real threat? Why, it was Claire. Claire was the only woman Locke had kissed other than Daphne in 20 years. But Locke Dixon hadn't pulled out her chair. "Okay, stop," she thought. "Back to the crucible." She needed to remember why they were there, to help people like Marcela Vallenda, to raise money, to fund programming, to improve people's lives. Claire wanted to get away from Locke, but the chairs were filling up quickly. She felt a momentary panic, as if this was a child's game. The music was going to stop at any second and she would have to grab a seat. And the only seat remaining was to Locke's right. Claire sat down. Now she and Isabel were flanking him. To Claire's right, thankfully, was Adams Fisk, with his mop of brown curls and glasses sliding down his nose. Claire adored him unconditionally. His youngest son, Ryan, was JD's best friend. Adams was in Claire's foxhole. He would watch her back. Isabel cleared her throat.
I've written up an agenda for the meeting, she said.
She opened up a luscious calfskin portfolio and took out a sheaf of papers, passed them around. Claire felt the first drop of poison sully the new waters of her relationship with Isabel.
She had written up an agenda?
All right, Claire thought. That made sense. She wouldn't travel all the way from New York City on a Wednesday in October to show up at a meeting unprepared. So, the agenda. Claire glanced at Locke, who had put on his bifocals.
48 hours earlier, they had been making out like a couple of teenagers in the other room, but now that seemed like a figment of Claire's imagination.
The first line item on Isabel's agenda was talent. Discuss talent possibilities. Assign talent point person. Create talent and production budget, including travel and accommodations. Isabel tucked her long hair behind one ear, then tossed the ends over her shoulder. It was a move from her personal theater, Claire could tell, and she knew she'd see a lot of Isabel's hair tossing between now and August. Another drop of poison in the well.
Since the gala is, in essence, a concert, Isabel said, I thought we'd start by discussing talent.
Claire opened her mouth to speak, but Brent Jackson beat her to it.
We got Max West, he said. Max West has agreed to play for free.
Isabel turned to Locke, slowly, deliberately. Claire and everyone else in the room watched, fascinated. Had Locke not told Isabel about Max West?
Max West, Isabel said.
Max West? She might have said his name with awe and admiration, or disbelief, but what Claire heard was disdain.
Do we want Max West?
Claire leaned against the back of her Windsor chair so that she could feel every one of her vertebrae, and she pressed her feet flat to the ground and simultaneously tried to lower her pelvis. She was creating her own yoga position. This distraction lasted for a few seconds before the shouting in her head began.
Do we want Max West?
That was like asking if they wanted Billy Joel, John Cougar Mellencamp, Tom Petty. Max West was probably the biggest cross-generational rock star in the whole world. He was right up there with Jimmy Buffett and Elton John. Do we want Max West? Was she kidding?
Hell yes, Brent Jackson said. That's why I'm here. I love Max West. Everybody loves Max West.
Isabel tilted her head back so that her nose pointed up.
I'm not sure he's right for our demographic, she said. Our leading donor demographic is 55 to 70.
That's the biggest money.
They don't want to hear Max West.
They want to hear Broadway. Adams said, With all due respect to our demographic, since Max West is willing to play for us for free, we are going with Max West.
I think that's a mistake, Isabel said. I really do. So there you had it. The well was poisoned. Claire hated Isabel French.
Siobhan had tried to warn Claire, but Claire had not heeded this warning. She had felt sorry for Isabel French.
Bad divorce, Locke had said, and some subsequent bad decisions.
But now Isabel was making Claire look like an ass in front of Adams, the committee, and Locke. Overriding Claire's embarrassment, her humiliation, her indignation, should she recite the litany of charitable organizations that wanted to get Max West and had no prayer? Should she inform Isabel that Max had turned down Bono? Was mounting anger at Locke. He should have told Isabel about Max West before the meeting started, and he should be defending Claire now. It had never crossed Claire's mind that there was a person alive who would not want Max West to play the benefit. Claire was completely blindsided. She was mute with rage. Locke said, I guess we could look into other options.
No, Claire said. All this time she had been staring into her lap, and there was a reason for that. She knew her face would be discolored. Her skin was milky white, but now she would have a red spot, round as an apple, on each cheek. She looked up at Brent Jackson and Tessa Klein, the magazine editor. God, what must she be thinking? Then turned to Isabel and Locke.
No way. If you make me cancel Max West after calling in this favor, I will quit.
She rose from her chair to show she was serious. But was this a threat? Did anyone care if she resigned as co-chair? Did Locke care?
Locke said to Isabel,
Claire brought us Max West. He's a friend of hers from high school.
He made it sound like Claire was a cat who had dropped a dead mouse at their feet.
Forget it, Claire said. She felt like a 9-year-old, a 7-year-old, a 4-year-old. I'll call him back and tell him we don't want him. I'll tell him he doesn't hit our demographic.
I've been talking to people too, Isabel said. Kristen Chenoweth, who is the hottest voice on Broadway right now, and Christine Ebersole is considering us too. I've known her manager for years.
Christine Ebersole? Said Lauren Van Alne. Never heard of her.
How old are you? Isabel said.
31.
Well, that's why.
I've never heard of Kristen Chenoweth, Brent Jackson said.
She's starring in the revival of South Pacific, Isabel said.
Her face is on every bus and billboard in the city. She is H-O-T.
What is your objection to Max West, Claire said, if I may ask? He has 8 platinum albums. He has 31 top 40 hits. He has mass appeal. He is a bona fide celebrity. Everyone knows him, and he will put ticket sales through the roof.
Nobody's going to pay $1,000 for someone they've never heard of, Francine Davis said.
There was silence. Everyone was waiting for Isabel to speak. When she did speak, she looked at Locke, though Claire was the one standing, demanding an answer. But Isabel appealed only to him.
Max West is a rock star, she said. His songs are loud, and some of them have an edge. Do we really want our elegant evening to end with screaming guitar?
It's mostly acoustic guitar, Brent Jackson pointed out. And incredible vocals.
I think he's tawdry, Isabel said. He's common, lowbrow. He will make the event seem cheap. We're not selling tickets to Fenway. This is an upscale event. We should get an upscale performer.
You have a point, Locke said.
I was asked to deliver Max West, Claire said. I have delivered Max West, but now I'm hearing we don't want him. I'm hearing he's not suitable. Is that how everybody feels?
No, Brent Jackson said. Why are we even having this conversation?
Why, indeed, Claire thought. She was glaring down at the bald spot on Locke's head with such heated vitriol that she expected it to catch fire. Do we want Max West or not? I'm happy to cancel him and walk. Adams took Claire's arm.
Don't cancel him. We're in the business of making money for this organization, and I think the best way to do that is to take the biggest star power we can get. Max is a coup for us, and he's willing to do it for free. In my mind, there's no question. Maybe we lose a few old folks who think his music is too loud, but we'll pick up younger people.
We're making a mistake, Isabel said. What about the man's personal life? The drugs, the drinking, the rehab, the affair with Savannah Bright splattered all over the tabloids. Is this a person we want representing a charity for children?
Claire put her hands to her burning cheeks. She couldn't decide which of many nasty things to think first.
What do you know about children? Do you even know who Big Bird is? And what about kissing another woman's husband on the dance floor of the Waldorf Astoria in front of 800 partygoers? What about the letter that came a week later asking you to rotate off the board of Manhattan East Hospital? Are you the right person to represent a charity for children?
We are sticking with Max West, Adams said.
Adams was always conciliatory, always open to other points of view and extending any debate. But tonight, his voice was firm. I don't want to talk about it any further. Isabel laughed derisively. She waved her hand.
Fine, she said. I'll pull my other lines out of the water. But let it be noted that I think we're making a mistake.
So noted, Adams said.
He's like the biggest name in the business, Brent Jackson said.
Isabel's smile was so fake it looked painful.
Okay, she said.
Fine.
Claire sat back down. Technically, she had won her point, and yet she felt defeated. Her own co-chair wasn't happy about Max West, and Locke had come dangerously close to rolling over on it. And this after he had asked her to pursue Matthew in the first place. Isabel had gotten her shots in, calling Matthew tawdry, common, lowbrow, and cheap. And because Matthew was Claire's friend, because they had grown up together and shared a history, Claire now felt she was the skanky ex-girlfriend of a motorcycle drug lord. She wasn't cut out for this kind of jockeying, or the politics. Claire didn't want to fight with Isabel. She didn't want to compete to see who would be the alpha dog. Although wasn't that what Isabel was doing? Wasn't that the point of her creating an agenda in the first place? Isabel was asserting her control, taking charge. It hadn't crossed Claire's mind to write up an agenda for the meeting. Claire had thought that Locke would run the meeting, or Adams would, but not her, and certainly not Isabel. Isabel said,
"We'll make Claire the point person for the talent, then. Okay with you, Claire?"
"Fine," Claire said. "I already delivered the contract and the rider." Adams held them up. "I have them right here. I will look them over." Next on the agenda were the invitations. Isabel knew a graphic designer in New York who would do them gratis. She said this word, gratis, instead of for free, and Claire shuddered. The graphic designer, Isabel said, was young and hip. He lived in Nolita. Claire understood that this was a neighborhood in Manhattan, but she didn't know where it was because the last time Claire had been to New York, Nolita hadn't existed.
"We need to revamp the invite design," Isabel said. "It's fusty. The past few years, the invites have been straight out of the retirement home."
"Perfect for our demographic," Claire thought. Isabel reached into her portfolio.
"I've copied the invitation list for each of you to look over. Please add people, delete people, make notes by anyone you know has died, or worse still, divorced."
She looked up for a laugh, but got none. Claire felt marginally better.
"This list is stagnant. It needs freshening up. We don't want it to be the same old people."
The same old 1,000 people, Claire thought.
"Like I said, having Max will bring in some new faces," Adams said.
"Yeah," Brent Jackson said. "Like me, finally. Someone I'd pay $1,000 to see."
Isabel sniffed.
"Is it all right with everyone if I spearhead invitations?"